When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello and welcome to Changes. It's Annie here. Absolutely delighted to have you with me after this Easter break. Hopefully it felt somewhat like a break for you. I'd love to know how you are and what changes, if any, you've been going through in your lives. Let me know on this email address, changespod@gmail.com. changespod@gmail.com. I want to hear from you. Tell me about some of the changes you've been going through, and also let us know what you thought of those changes focus episodes that we brought you over the last few weeks. I know I'm biased, but I thought they were excellent. Really great shop windows for what we do here on Changes, focusing on themes that lots of people touch on, namely education and parenting. Anyway, love to hear from you. On with the show. It is our 13th series starting today. Can you believe that? I am so excited to bring you a very special guest today. She is a globally best-selling phenomenon. She is one of the most successful Irish authors of all time. Her name is Marion Keyes. Marion is the queen of contemporary fiction, having written 16 novels that have sold over 35 million copies worldwide. On top of that, she's published 3 collections of her journalism, written a cookbook, and co-hosted the hit BBC Radio 4 programme Now You're Asking. Marion's writing covers some of the most pressing issues of today, including mental health, addiction, domestic violence, immigration, and the Repeal the 8th campaign, all through the lens of her very light touch. Marion herself is open about her own history with alcoholism and talks in a refreshingly honest way about her appearance and getting older. This episode is no exception. Her new book, My Favourite Mistake, which has just been released, is an absolute must read for all women. I loved it, and you will hear why. It's an honour to welcome to Changes, Marion Keyes. So first of all, how are you?
I'm great, really.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, you'll know this. Anytime before a book comes out, I go a bit mad.
Still?
Oh, God, yeah. It's got worse. But now that I'm actually, it's too late to do anything. I can't make any more changes. And I've already started talking to people about it. I sort of feel, okay, I did my best. Mm. I did what I could.
And do you enjoy talking about the books after you write them?
I do, I suppose. I mean, yeah, I do, because
it's still quite raw, I can imagine. It's not, you don't have that big a remove from it.
No, and I'm always keen that people, this is pathetic, you know, that people will know what I was trying to say. I'm very like, now this is the point I was making, you know,
yeah,
like I want people to know that there was intention behind,
of course,
what I wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very nice to talk about it.
I wonder, like, even just that, like the wanting to people to know there's intention, it feels like there's a sense of you assuming that people won't think that you have depth as a writer.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? That's interesting to me.
Yeah. It took me a long time to realise that I had spent my career kind of operating from a defensive position. You know, that I went into every interview expecting to be mocked and scorned. And I mean, I would say to anyone doing something they love and getting a certain amount of reward for it, don't think like that. I wish I hadn't, you know, with my earlier books. Mm. I just wished I thought, I'm doing something I love. I'm so lucky to be doing it. And some people like it. And to lean into the gratitude rather than be trying to explain how I was misunderstood and that chick lit was a pejorative. And, you know, I mean, maybe it's just being 60. That's made me think I should have been always positive. But I suppose you can't know until you know. But yeah, I suppose I do feel like, I mean, especially for people who haven't read me,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the minute they hear my name, they often flinch and their eye goes a bit twitchy.
You think there's an assumption there?
Yeah, there is an assumption.
And what is that assumption?
That I'm, frothy, frivolous, glittery, Prosecco, high heels, silliness, girliness. no depth, no worth.
One of the things that really struck me through reading My Favourite Mistake, the new book, and also just reading interviews and listening to you talking, is this relentless honesty. It feels like you are so honest and so true to yourself. I know you mentioned that maybe you haven't always felt that way, but it really comes across in your writing.
Thank you.
And in the way you speak about your life and stuff. I suppose, does writing do that to you? Does it help you be honest?
God, I don't know. You see, I was always without boundaries.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a good thing. And I still don't have any, really.
Right.
I mean, I try because it's healthier for relationships. But I just never understood that if somebody asked you a question, you didn't have to answer it fully and honestly. Mm. And then with a lot of things about me, I'm glad that I'm honest. Like, I think I would have found life very difficult being sort of in the public eye and being a recovering alcoholic. Yeah. I don't like secrets. For me, I don't like carrying secrets because it makes me feel vulnerable and icky. It just makes me feel, ugh.
Yeah.
This is just me. Anybody else, like, do whatever you need to do to keep yourself safe. But I just would prefer me. It's just easier. Even lies of omission don't sit well with me.
Let's get on to change.
Okay.
How are you with it?
Oh, I hate it. Oh my God. I mean, I absolutely, unless it's change from something that has stopped being comfortable or stopped working.
Right.
But most of the time, I'm easy to scare. Like, no, this is going to be a disaster. You know, it's not going to work out and I'm going to lose everything. And like I'm a wonderful catastrophist. I'm not great on change, but it's inevitable. Mm. You know, like there's no way of sidestepping it. And there was a time when I was younger when I thought at some stage I'll just be so in control of myself and of my life that there will be no unpleasant anythings.
Yeah.
You know, everything will just kind of hum along in a nice, steady, almost dull kind of contentment. And nothing will come along and upheaval me. But the upheaval, we are like on shifting ground the whole time, humans, until the day we die.
Mm.
Well, I mean, I'm only 60, but like that's been my experience so far, that I might get spells of, yeah, God, this is great. Long may it last. And suddenly like, whoops.
The rug is pulled.
Yeah. And if it's not external circumstances, it's changes in me.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to your first childhood change then. Can you remember what you said?
Yes, I did. Mm. I said I fell in love with reading.
Okay.
And you see, I found childhood incredibly challenging.
Mm.
I found the world really frightening. I mean, I don't know why. I think I just came out of the box.
You were the oldest, right?
I was, yeah.
Of five.
Yeah. Mm. And I found other human beings confounding. I just never knew what the right thing to do was.
Mm.
And I spent a lot of my time kind of watching other people and listening to what they said and thinking, if I do and say what they do, then I can pass myself off as normal.
Mm.
I was afraid all the time of getting into trouble or of something bad happening. I mean, but even now, like I think of Ireland in black and white when I remember those times. Like I was born in 1963, which does feel like the dark ages now in terms of the changes. And it felt to me like the whole country was afraid of getting into trouble. You know, like the power of the church was like it was a theocracy in all but name. And both my parents came from not the middle class. Like my mother came from a very small farm in County Clare and my dad came from the inner city in Limerick. They absolutely were lovely and they absolutely did their best with me. But I think they both felt a slight sense of that they didn't really belong.
Got you.
And I think I picked up on that, that I didn't belong or that we weren't as good as, or, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
So I don't remember stories of other books before Enid Blyton. I just remember Enid Blyton. And it was like suddenly we go from a black and white movie to when it changes into colour in The Wizard of Oz. And it gave me such escape. Like, it took me away from this baffling world where I was afraid of everything.
Mm.
And it just gave me this massive, massive relief and escape and pleasure. I mean, I've often said, like, reading was my first addiction.
Wow.
You know, and I remember, like, my dad coming in to my bedroom one night. I was about, I don't know, 6 or 7, and telling me it was time to go to sleep and to turn off the light. So he turned off the light. But then I tried to keep reading in the dark because I was so agonized at the thought of leaving the world of the book and coming back. It's like in The Little Match Girl when the match goes out. That's what it felt like. Everything went back to sort of grey and ashy and awful. And so books were my first comfort, my first escape, the first thing I really loved. And it stayed that way always.
Did you ever think that you could be a writer? Was that something when you were a child that was on the table? No.
Not a chance. Like, not a chance. I'm trying to wonder why that was. I mean, again, it was the Ireland of the time. But, like, it was all about you get a safe, you do something safe.
Yeah.
You do something permanent and pensionable.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of the holy grail was to work in the bank or the civil service because then you would be taken care of. And I don't know. Writers just seemed like people from another planet. I couldn't even imagine them. And, like, this was, like, well into my 20s that I thought, like, writers came from a long line of writers, the way people would come from a long line of cattle farmers or something, you know, that it was always in the family and it was kind of, you were born into it and it was your inherited craft. I just would never have had the audacity to think that somebody like me could do something as brave and pushy. I would have thought it was pushy that I was kind of leaving my lane and moving into an entirely different lane.
And also the act of putting something out there in the world for people and the expectation for them to read it. Like,
oh, the arrogance of that, would never. Like, my expectations from life were really low.
But, you know, for those listening, I don't feel like any of what you're talking about is remotely like an anomaly to you. Like, that to me feels very normal in terms of Ireland and Irishness, especially in women. I think that sense of a kind of inherent shame and just that sense of not ever feeling like you're in a position to speak out or put yourself in front of people.
I'd forgotten about that. You're absolutely right. I mean, the worst thing, and it was really, really difficult for my mother when I did get published, the worst thing was for a woman to cause controversy, you know, to stick her head above the parapet and voice something that could be counter to whatever the, you know, the common wisdom was at the time. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
Mm.
Like, that women were, you know, quiet and meek, obedient, biddable, looked after other people.
Mm.
And, you know, confidence, I kind of joke about this, but, like, you know, Irish women, it felt to me, mothers, kind of took pride in raising children with no self-esteem.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you had a confident child, you know, you'd be mortified. Yeah. Like, the last, it's the kind of, and a confident daughter, like, no way.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it was, you know, it was of its time.
Mm.
But,
Just going back to your family real quick, I suppose everyone in a family, especially in a big family, there's a sense of everyone having a role to play. What was your role in
your
family?
I was a mini dad.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
and what was that?
Oh my God. Right. I was, I mean, they call me the Sergeant Major still. I'm very kind of, I'm a bit like it still, standing at the bottom of the stairs with the clipboard, ticking us all off as we come down the stairs, yelling at the latecomers, kind of very much the sheepdog to my dad's farmer. I was the one kind of rounding people up and trying to manage them for him. Yeah, I was kind of like the underling, the second in command.
And how does being part of a family like that manifest? What about being in that family is part of you? Like,
I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. I'm trying to put words in it because I am, it's one of the things I absolutely, I love in real life and I love writing about it.
Yeah.
I like the way families are just a random selection of people. Even though you may come from the same gene pool, family members are often nothing alike.
Yeah.
I mean, every single one of my siblings and I, we're all really different.
Yeah.
But because you're united by blood, you have to spend time together. And it's interesting that, like, you know, when we grow up and we become autonomous, we make other families. Mm. You know, we make friends with people that we really like.
Yeah.
I mean, I absolutely adore every single member of my family. But, like, we don't always have
not
things
all
in
compatible.
Common.
Yeah.
Exactly. We're not all compatible. Yeah. We're far from compatible. And I kind of like that.
Yeah.
I like our differences. Mm. I like the way we disagree about things. I like the way we were all given very kind of rigid identities fairly early on. And even though in the rest of our lives we're not those people, when we're together, we are. And I like, you know, I feel very kind of disappointed when there's only 17 of the 18 of us. I know it's really weird. And it's why I like writing about families, because the boundaries of a family are kind of malleable.
Yeah.
You know, that like people will forgive a lot within a family that you mightn't forgive in other relationships.
Mm.
And with my family, like, I love just how rude I can be.
Yeah.
You know, like if people are bored with the conversation, they'll just pick up their plate and they'll go to another room. And you can be as weird or as engaged as you like.
Yeah.
And nobody minds.
Yeah.
With those people, I am entirely myself.
Mm.
I am the oddball that I still am.
Mm.
I can give it free rein.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I have to tailor myself for them. In any way.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, to have that freedom.
Mm.
I mean, and I have it with friendships as well. But en masse, I like the feeling that there's enough of us that there will always be somebody that you can complain to, or there'll be somebody who's like, I'm with you. Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Tell me about the biggest change in your adulthood, please, Marion.
Okay, the biggest change that I made in my adult life was at the age of 30, I accepted help for my alcoholism and I did everything I was told to, and I was lucky enough to get sober. And that is the most fundamental thing that has ever happened to me or will ever happen to me.
Mm.
It's impossible to overstate how much it changed my life. I mean, I spent the first 30 years of my life baffled by it all. Like, just
baffled
kind of,
by life.
Yeah,
right?
And people and myself.
Mm.
I was just kind of lurching around in this fog. And I was so self-destructive and I sabotaged any gifts that I had. I had a degree and I was clever. But anything I achieved, the moment it was mine, it became sort of sullied. You see, I didn't grow up. I was really immature emotionally. And I was also very full of resentment against other people. Like, I felt like life was a zero-sum game And if you got something, Annie, it meant there was less for me.
Right.
You know, so I couldn't be happy for anyone else. I just felt they took some of the good fortune out of the universe and just meant that there was even less of it to go around. And when I was enabled to put down the glass and to start doing the things and spending time with people who helped me to take responsibility for the way I had been living and to learn to live through the slings and arrows of everyday life and to do it without having to self-medicate, that grew me up eventually. And it has given me gratitude. Like, I was always, always depressed because alcohol is...
And did you know you were depressed?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were conscious of that.
Yeah, and I felt miserable and I, you know, and there was no joy in anything I felt. And then I learned, you know, that alcohol is a fairly hefty depressant and that was part of it. So when I wasn't drinking any longer, my mood changed. Yeah. I mean, and I am still prone to bouts of, I don't know, hopelessness or... But that's separate from my alcoholism.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, I mean, I get very excited about things. I get very happy about things. When I love, when I like something, I adore it.
Yeah.
Like, I still have that alcoholic thing of like, there's no dimmer switch. It's all about like, you know, I'm black or white. I'm, you know, I'm on or off.
Yeah.
And when I'm on, I'm so on. I'm just so excited. And yeah, I didn't know I was that kind of person. I always thought also I was crippled with shyness. And I'm not shy. I'm other things.
Right.
I'm an introvert and I need a lot of time away from people. But I'm also, I'm quite confident in other ways.
Yeah.
It changed everything. And it made me capable of loving in a mature way. And of being able to accept love. To kind of realise that I deserved a healthy love.
Yeah.
You know, because when I was drinking, it was all about, the bad boys and the drama and the door slam. And I thought that was love.
Yeah.
And all it was fake emotion to fill those empty places in me.
How long did it take from the moment you talked about being enabled to go to rehab to then feeling, I mean, coming out of rehab, I suppose, and feeling like you were ready for the world as much as one could be?
You see, when I went into rehab, I honestly thought there was nothing wrong. I swear to God, I thought I was depressed and I was going through a hard time and alcohol was the only thing that was helping me.
Right. So you saw it as a medicine, kind of like a...
I honestly did. It was more than that. It was my best friend. It was my only. It was the only thing that really, really, really added value to my life.
Okay.
I'd say about 10 days, once I was in there 10 days, I was like, oh, fuck. You know, like, and I was so angry and so grief stricken that I had let myself go in there. Once I could see, I could never unsee. Once I saw that alcohol was never going to be my friend again, it was never going to make me happy the way it used to make me. And then I saw that like every time something bad happened to me, alcohol was the cause. And then I saw it wasn't normal to drink the way I drank. Like, I had always looked for oblivion. Erase me. Just wipe me out fast so I don't have to be me. I don't have to be conscious of being me. And I thought, that's not really living. And like, so I was upset because I thought, I'm only 30. I thought, how come other people are managed? You know, they don't get into trouble until they're 55 was the figure I had in my head, you know. And I was thinking the rest of my life is just going to be this absolute dry shite misery.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to be crawling through this desert of no alcohol. And it's going to be really boring, I thought, and joyless.
Yeah.
And then I'll die. I actually hadn't started living at all until I stopped, until I was helped to stop. Not everything in my life has been lovely since. But even on my worst days, it wasn't as bad as when I was drinking.
Yeah. After you came out of rehab, your first book was published. You also, and please correct me if I'm wrong, did you meet Tony around then?
I knew him beforehand, before I went into rehab.
Right.
And as I was still in my bad boy phase then.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand why somebody would be nice to me.
Tony's the husband, by the
yeah.
way.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I came out of rehab, I felt differently. I felt really hopeful about life. I mean, I did what I was supposed to do. Like, I stayed close to other recovering alcoholics.
Yeah.
I learned from the people who had been sober longer than me. Like, I went to therapy. And I realised that I had never thought that I was worth somebody being kind to me. And Tony's really kind. And all he was kind. You know, and he turned up when he said he would, which was like, Jesus, that's novel. You know, he was nice to me. I thought, actually, I like this. So, and we'd so much in common. And that had never mattered to me before.
Right.
You know, it was all about chemistry and our eyes met across a crowded orgy or whatever, you know. And no, it was just, my expectations, my wants were different.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd finally started treating myself as if I deserved nice things.
Yes. Can we talk about the book, please?
Oh, yes. Thanks very much.
My favourite mistake. Now, you mentioned you like writing about families. This is about one member of the Walsh family who you write about a lot. And it's about Anna Walsh. You have described it on your Instagram as a hopeful book about change.
Yeah. Can I say that even though it's about a family I've written about before, it's a standalone
book.
Oh,
you don't need to.
You definitely don't
need to read any of the other books. Yeah.
And it's about kind of referring back to what I was saying earlier, that I was waiting to get to a phase in my life where everything was fixed and perfect. And it's never going to be that way. And during the pandemic, I remembered things that I regret that I had done, you know, mistakes I had made. And I had tried at the time to do the best, you know, in a situation. And then I realised that I'd handle it differently now, you know, now that I'm older and with the benefit of hindsight. And then this is also a love story about people who knew each other 20 years ago and their paths crossed, but it never really happened. They got married to other people and now they're, you know, they've met again. And it's about how do you deal with the mistakes we've made? Because no one gets to middle life without having a couple of things that, for which we're truly regretful or truly ashamed of. It's about kind of redemption, like self-forgiveness and also that thing like that you can change your life. Like, you know, I'm not going to say that life, you know, when things fall apart, maybe it's just you're waiting for better things to fall together. I mean, no, stop it now. But like that we can become comfortable and happy in circumstances that we hadn't planned for and that we wouldn't have wished for.
Yeah.
And it's also a book about love. See, I'm a great believer that people continue to fall in love. Well, you know, it's not the preserve of 20-somethings, you know, or 30-somethings or 40-somethings. Like
Anna's 50 in the book, am I right?
Yeah, she's 48.
She's 48.
Yeah, and the person that she is, he's 52.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, ancient. Mm. I say that with a twinkle in her
with
eye.
With a glint in your eye.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Jesus, I would have thought that, you know. I thought, actually, it's funny. I was reading a book the other day. It was about a woman who's 63. And she'd found her husband cheating and she left him and she ran away to New York. And I thought, God, 63, why would I be reading about a 63? And, oh, hold on, wait now, I'm 60, wait. You know, because you hear these... You hear these ages. Well, I hear them and I think nothing to do. Oh, hold on. It is plenty to do with me.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yes.
So, I mean, on reading the book, it kind of pulled me in and held me from early on. I felt really like held by the story and also just by Anna herself, who, as we've just learned, 48 years old, loves a pastry, gets her Botox, is like fiercely honest and independent, but flawed. As we all are.
Yeah.
And it's just so refreshing to read about a character who's just, it's just so honest. And there's a kind of, I was trying to think about how you feel upon finishing it. There's a sense of relief. It's a sense of relief of feeling so represented and seen.
Oh God, you're so nice.
But that's just me. But that must happen to you all the time as a writer. Like you must have a legion of women who come to you and say, thank you for writing me.
I mean, the weird thing is that, like, I felt so disconnected all my life. And then when I started writing, people said to me, that's me. You wrote the way I feel about X or Y. And it just, that's been the greatest gift for me, is people letting me know that I'm not the weirdo. It comes back to kind of me being honest. Like, I will write about my shameful feelings, like, you know, jealousy, or like, you know, messing up a friendship. And and as you say, the carbs, you know, it's almost like carbs are illegal.
Also the sex.
The sex.
Having this woman having wild and fucking brilliant sex. You know, you don't often get to hear or read about that.
And I think that's a shame.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, and I, you know, look, we are allowed to be whatever way we are. And like, one of Anna's sisters is happily dead from the neck down. Like, that's how she is. She is absolutely at peace with it. You know, and so is her partner. They are happily dead from the neck down together. But I really, it bothers me when women are presented as joyless about sex, or like, or that we kind of shut up shop, you know, the minute we get, you know, a ring on our finger. God, for, you know, that's such an awful phrase.
Yeah.
You know, or that women will only, that they don't enjoy sex and that they only use it for leverage, or that they dole it out like, you know, like something very, very precious on birthdays, anniversaries, and at Christmas. You know, there's plenty of women who love sex, or they love it for a while and then they're too tired if they've gone off it, they don't fancy a man anymore, whatever, whatever their circumstances are, they go off it for a while. And then things change and they're like, oh, hello, you know, I'm back as a sexual creature. And that it's an identity that can morph as we move through life. But like Anna, you know, she split up with her long-term partner and they hadn't had sex for a long time. And she'd gone on HRT and suddenly, like, everything was back in, you know, work in order. And she was, you know, on the loose in New York. It was before she left. And she thought, well, look, I'm going to enjoy myself.
Yeah.
What I really like about her, she's one of my favourite characters, is that she's very kind of ordinary. But at the same time, she's like, you can't shame her about sex. You know, she just thinks it's available
it's
to her.
It's her right.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's her right.
It's her right. And she's unapologetic about it.
Just for the listeners, I brought a book for Marion to read. We're interviewing the author of that book on another episode. But something in that book really struck me, was just this idea of maybe it is the birthright of women to be promiscuous.
Yes.
And maybe that is the huge skeleton in civilization's closet that we were never taught that was allowed or aspirational or just like our God-given right. Like,
yes.
And it's so lovely to read about a promiscuous woman.
Yes. And like,
who's 48?
She's 48 and she's no intention of stopping yet. That's so interesting what you've just said. You know, but like, it was how society was, they kept a lid on it.
Yes.
Because, you know, if the women were off riding left, right and centre, it was a far harder job for the men to keep it all under control. But because they were the ones running things, you know, they could be promiscuous because they were the ones who made the rules.
Let's just get onto mistakes quickly, because in the blurb of the book, it says, we all make mistakes, but when do we stop making the same one over and over again? Marion, what is your most repeated mistake?
Oh, let me see. You know the phrase, fight or flight, you know, when we're afraid.
Yes, yes.
Fight or flight or freeze is another one.
Mm-hmm.
But I recently heard another other one called fawn.
Right.
Yeah. So when I'm afraid, I don't fight and I do show up, so I don't flight. Sometimes I freeze, which I'll come back to. But often I will fawn.
Yeah.
I will meet the person I dislike and have to meet for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And instead of establishing my boundaries.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got slightly better at this, but I end up instead bending over by fawning.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I understand why. I mean, I've done it with men in the past. You know, when I was afraid of being assaulted, you know, like women do it. We become really, really nice to them. It's one of the ways that women keep themselves safe. I mean, I'm not talking in particular about, me and men, but just in general, kind of trying to kind of calm them, placate them,
you know.
And then I hate myself for doing it when I come away. And so I've got better at, you see, freezing was another thing when people would say something insulting or cheeky to me. And instead of me saying, how dare you, or, you know, I go inside myself for words and there is nothing.
Right.
And that's actually freezing. And these are responses from the amygdala.
Yeah.
They're not something we have any choice over.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So it's very hard to unlearn them. But yeah, I fawn when instead I should be not even fighting, but just shutting things down.
Yeah.
And I have made strides recently, but it's still difficult.
I was reading a thing by Emma Barnett.
I do, of course, yeah.
About how women overcompensate in conversation a lot of the time with men, and they're given very little and they just go, try and fill the gaps, try and go around the houses with words to make everything okay. And she did this experiment where she just said the bare minimum, like the man, and was just, she said it was so empowering. But her job as an interviewer is to be comfortable with silences.
Yes.
So she's good at that.
Yeah.
It's very hard to do.
I'd say it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never actually tried. Wouldn't it be great?
Just to say the minimum.
Just for the crack. Just, you know, no.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe. Dunno. Dunno is even better.
Dunno.
Dunno. Dunno that either.
How has turning 60 changed things for you, if at all?
Kind of not at all, Annie, in one way. Like, I don't mind aging. I mean, at all. Like, I've always felt more comfortable getting older. I was never a good young person. I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't enjoy any of the benefits. But the word 60, especially for women, I mean, that's the age when women traditionally retired. Like when we were put out to pasture, you know, when we really were deemed to be beyond any useful purpose whatsoever. But I feel about 43.
Yeah.
43 is an excellent age,
oh,
I think.
Yeah.
I suppose aging has also changed in that, like, I was going to say with the fish oils and everything, but I don't take any fish oils. Like, I live on absolute rubbish. But, like, I don't know. You know, I'm still doing new things. Mm. Like, I've started rock climbing, doing via ferratas. And
stop.
Yes. God, I'm so tediously proud of that.
Good.
But, like, yeah, you can be 60 and you can do new things or not, if you prefer. That's the beauty of it. Like, nobody has to do anything. But I like the kind of the point that you don't have to stop either,
right,
if you don't want.
Yeah.
Yeah, that age has become something far less prescriptive than it used to.
Yeah.
And I think I've got slightly better. I've got better at understanding myself.
Mm.
You know, that, like, many of the mistakes I made when I was younger, like in friendships and in relationships, they were because I didn't have a full sense of who I was.
Mm.
And I was afraid to say my truth, or then I'd go through those spells of standing up for myself because it was about time, and then I'd overdo it, you know, and I'm just better at that. But I am a very slow learner. And I think that's the whole thing about life, is that we are slow learners and we don't know until we know.
Marianne, what is a change you'd still like to make or see?
I would love to know the fundamentals of interior design.
Ooh.
Because there are rules.
There are.
And they are guarded like the secrets of the, you know, some arcane discipline. And it's to do with things like proportion, you know, or, you
light,
know, how you
light,
or how you balance colour, that you have your main colour, then you have your second colour.
And textures.
Textures. You've done this.
No, I've just had a room renovated. So
I've been
learning myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, I knitted for like a short, insane patch of time. Before that, I used to paint ginormous canvases.
I'm dying to see one of your canvases.
Oh,
I heard you talk about it. So I really want to see some of your paintings.
I'll send you some photos. Mm. Before that, I upcycled furniture. Mm. Before that, I used to make and decorate cakes.
So you clearly need to do things with your hands.
I do. I love colour.
Yeah.
And I love assembling things. I would just love to know how to do it right.
Yeah. You mentioned as well self-acceptance as a maybe.
Yeah.
Would you be wanting to talk about that or not?
I would, because it's the lifelong battle. Like, it ties into everything. I mean, definitely my appearance. Like, it's really hard as a woman to just be as I am.
It's one of my favourite things that you do is talk about the fact that you get, you know, fillers and
Botox. Yeah.
I just think it's actually a really radical act of kindness to women. Honestly, I cannot tell you. Like, you just don't see people talking about it out loud. You put it on your Instagram.
I did because, thank you, that's so nice of you.
It's true.
Well, yeah, so I have fillers and I have Botox and sometimes I have Profilo. I mean, that's a lot.
I don't know what that is.
Profilo, okay. Profilo is, it's hyaluronic acid injected subdermally and it stimulates collagen.
Right.
So it doesn't kind of do anything obvious, but it just makes you look bursty and fresh.
So people go, you look well.
You look, well. Yes.
You look well.
You look well slept, well rested.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people were saying to me, you look well. You look well rested. And I couldn't just sit there and smile and go, ha ha, drinking lots of water, staying out of the sun. I just thought, I cannot do it to other women. Mm. I cannot say it's down to double cleansing or whatever. You know, and I'm not saying anyone else who does what I do should out themselves. Do what you need to
do. Each
to
their own.
But I couldn't. It comes back to what I hate secrets. Mm. And I would just rather, like people were saying on Instagram, you have to tell me what skincare you use. And I thought that won't actually do any good.
Yeah.
And that just made me feel better. Mm. I hate even saying this because it's so out of step with the times. I struggle with my weight, you know, like I love sugar. And I was like so many of us just so programmed that there's only one way to look if you're a woman, you know, like 12 foot tall and 4 stone.
Yeah.
And I will never be that person. So I'm in a constant battle of trying to have what I like and trying to forgive myself for how I look. And I spend so much of my life worrying about food and what I eat and what I weigh and hating photographs of myself. And I just thought, it's meaningless. It's absolutely meaningless. Mm. Like, I'm a well-intentioned person. Like, I do my best to be decent and kind. And that I spend time in my head thinking, oh, fuck. You know, all that bread I ate.
Yeah.
You know, that'll be on my gravestone.
Yeah.
You know.
It's the epitaph.
Yeah.
Marion Keyes, all that bread she ate.
Yeah. And like, I mean, bread is such a wonderful thing.
Oh, it's one of my favourite things in the world.
It's the best thing in life, yes.
With salted butter. Like, you just can't go wrong with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really.
But isn't it so annoying that we are conditioned to, you know, have to forgive ourselves for eating this stuff or just be raging with ourselves.
Yeah.
You're right. It's such a waste of time and energy.
Yeah.
But also it's there.
It's
lovely to be honest about it and true about it because I think we all feel that. We all feel that.
And, you know, I see the change in generations after me. And I love that. You know, I love the way people refuse to be shamed.
Yeah.
Like you can't. You know, and I love that people have reclaimed the word fat.
Yeah.
And saying you can't use it as a slur. It's simply a descriptor.
Yeah.
I would love to be there. And maybe I'll never get there. I want to try because I'm alive and I have enough to eat and I am functional. I can walk. You know, there's so much I can do.
Right.
And I've so much to be grateful and happy for. And instead, you know, like a good, I don't know, 7 or 8% of my brain is constantly at me.
Yeah.
About the bread.
Yeah.
Or the whatevers.
You're making me want some bread now.
Yeah. Mary. I was saying, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Did have God, it in my head there.
Vienna roll. Oh, stop. Yeah.
So the book we have been discussing is called My Favourite Mistake. It is the new book from Marion Keyes. It is out now. As I speak, you can go and get it. You can go and buy it and you will not regret it. Go and meet Anna Walsh and fall in love with her like I did. Listen, Marion, thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. It was so lovely to meet you.
And
it's such an honour to be here.
If you enjoyed this episode, you are in for such a treat, as coming up next week, we are starting a mini-series on bodies and change. World-leading gynaecologist Dr. Jen Gunter will be answering your questions on everything from menopause to menstruation. We have pop star C-Mat, who hit the news recently wearing a dress showing her bum crack to the Brit Awards. She's going to be discussing self-esteem and body confidence.
And renowned academic and journalist Afua Hirsch, the author of the book Decolonizing My Body, will be talking about her personal journey, unpacking Eurocentric beauty standards and unlearning some of the myths we've all been conditioned to believe around women's bodies. I'm really looking forward to getting stuck in and for you to hear these conversations. That is a mini series on bodies here on Changes. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out. And as always, we are so grateful for you listening and sharing and just telling people about this podcast. We never take it for granted. Thank you for listening. Changes is produced by Louise Mason with assistant production from Anna DeWolf Evans. See you next week.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.